Thank you very much, Sarah.
And also thank you very much for organizing it. As already Dean Zimmerman said, I mean, it's really Sarah's work that we are all together here. And I'm really grateful for this opportunity, since I'm an assistant professor and pretty new to FSU. For me, that's a great opportunity to learn about the people who work at this place and exchange some ideas. Okay, I'm talking about Goethe now, 300 years later, and a pretty much very different concept of genius. Genius is here rather an original source of fantasy and creativity and of imagination controlling it. Okay. We are all familiar with the genie in the bottle tale of 1001 Nights. A fisherman retrieves a bottle from the bottom of the sea, and by opening it, he releases a powerful and threatening genie that was captured there for 1800 years. This story could almost serve as an allegory of Western and particular German culture in the 18th century, since it showcases an astonishing parallel with the fisherman's tale. Like the genie, the powerful creative potential of the imagination was literally bottled up during the 1800-year-long regime of Christian ideology, which ended officially with the collapse of the Holy Roman Empire of German nations in 1806. The political theology of Christianity, from Augustine's doctrine of primordial sin to Spanish Inquisition, systematically controlled the human imagination by condemning individual creativity. One must only think of the warning images of the devil, of heretics and witches, or in positive terms, of the exemplary holy figures like the Virgin Queen and the saints who sacrificed their fancies and sensual pleasures to a higher divine authority. However, as soon as the Enlightenment spirit has revealed this theological regime as an imaginary belief system, the human imagination is set free again. Like the fisherman in the tale, European man sees himself now suddenly confronted with the release potential of his imagination, and that immediately spins out of control since he has not yet learned how to govern it. I mean, this is only in very broad terms. I mean, just to draw a big picture here. Let me give you two examples to illustrate this. First, the 18th century sees a dramatic increase of fairies, spirits, ghosts, and visions everywhere. A prominent example is Swedenborg's Ghosseer, which provokes Kant to write a review that lays the foundations of his later critical philosophy. A second example is Goethe's The Sufferings of Young Werther, which depicts the prototypical romantic hero who commits suicide due to the incommensurability of his passions and fancies. The novel becomes a major literary success, but it also results in many cases of copycat suicides, known also as the Werther effect. This phenomenon, among others, motivates Goethe to critically reflect about the power and effects of the imagination in general and of his poetic genius in particular. The big question of the 18th century is, how can the creative and fantastic powers in us be liberated and at the same time be controlled? How, in other words, can the imagination or genius self-regulate its activity? In the following, I will show how a modern reconceptualization of genius has emerged in the writings of German philosophers and poets in the second half of the 18th century, and what measures they propose to direct and regulate the creative force within us, without making concessions to its potential, and without instituting yet another ideological regime of imagination governed by external force, so be it by authority of God, by power of state laws and church rules, by brute violence, or even by pure reason. My talk will focus primarily on Goethe's genius and discuss exemplary figures that he conceives as representatives of genius and of the self-regulation of genius. These figures are, first, Shakespeare. He becomes the inspiring model of genius for Lessing, Herder, and Goethe. Apart from Shakespeare, another figure is Prometheus. Goethe's famous ode about this mythical figure of creating man performs the emancipation of genius and the self-positing of a creative eye, but it also shows the essential blindness of the imagination in the creative act. I will talk a little bit more about Prometheus, And you have the poem on the handout, since I have no time to read it in full. So you can read it at home for your enjoyment. And therefore, third, Goethe's 8 hymns of genius, so one of it is Prometheus, try to close such blind spots by the self-reflection of his poetic acts. So Goethe wrote basically 8 big hymns, genius hymns, that all somehow try to reflect on genius in the act of creation. And finally, Goethe discovers an analogy between the poetic acts of genius and organic nature. This insight is articulated in the later poem, The Metamorphosis of Plants, which is also influenced by Kant's definition of genius from the Critique of Judgment. So this is the plan for my talk. And you find also The Metamorphosis of Plants on the back. It's a very long poem, and I can only touch it. I cannot really discuss about it, but it's an interesting poem to read. Okay, if we want to understand the emergence of an aesthetic of genius in the late 18th century, we should at least take a short glimpse into 17th century metaphysics. I will be very brief. First, Spinoza was, and for many still is, infamous for his pantheistic position as expressed in the formula Deus sive natura, which essentially means that God is not an outside observer of his creation, the so-called natura naturata, but that he manifests himself as an immanent force of nature, so-called natura naturans. Second, Leibniz metaphysics attempts to reconcile God, both in terms of an outside observer of nature and in terms of an immanent force in nature. In the monadology, Leibniz defines monads as simple substances with distinct qualities that cannot be altered by outside force and that strive in an entelechy towards perfection as driven by their specific internal principle. Each monad is complete in itself, but only the various perspective of all monads together mirror the multifaceted complexion of creation and constitute the absolute viewpoint that would be God's. On the basis of the monadological and entelechic principles of self-forming creation, late 18th century poetics invents the aesthetics of genius. It no longer understands the arts as an imitation of the appearance of nature. Instead, it considers the arts to be adequately expressed realizations and creations of the autonomous force and exemplary individuality of genius. Shakespeare becomes the first exemplary figure of this new type of artist for a new generation of German poets and literary critics. In one of the earliest German statements on an aesthetic of genius, Lessing writes in 1759, quote, "If only Shakespeare's masterpieces were translated into German, I know they would have a much better influence on our taste than Corneille and Racine have now. This is because genius can only be ignited by genius, and best by such genius who seems to owe all his skills only to nature and who is not afraid of the cumbersome striving towards perfection." End quote. Here, Shakespeare's work is seen as an example of how the German spirit can emancipate itself from what Lessing regards as bad taste and influence of neoclassicist French plays, which he considers to be poetically and socially obsolete. Yet Lessing still feels indebted to the Aristotelian principles of drama. Nature and genius do not yet mean something irrational. To Lessing, genius is rather the natural effect that a skilled artist achieves in an audience when he constructs a play according to the correct understanding and application of Aristotelian rules. Contrary to Lessing's enlightened constructivism, Herder celebrates Shakespeare's genius in 1771 as an organic and intuitive manifestation of human creativity. Like a monad, his concept of genius contains a whole universe without the genius taking notice of other things in the world. Quote, "If any man brings to mind that tremendous image of one seated high atop some craggy eminence, whirlwinds, tempest, and the roaring sea at his feet, but with the flashing skies about his head, that man is Shakespeare. Only we might add that below him, at the very base of his rocky throne, murmur the multitudes who explain, defend, condemn, excuse, worship, slander, translate, and reduce him, all of whom he cannot hear." End quote. This passage coins a romantic metaphor of genius as an autonomous and sublime figure, who mimics God's concentrative mood in the moment of creation. Herder further believes that each culture culminates in one genius, whose poetic oeuvre reflects and represents the manifold tendencies and struggles of his time in a perfect whole. For Herder, Shakespeare is a teacher, mover, and cultivator of Northern culture. Quote, individual impressions of peoples, estates, souls, all the most various and independently acting machines, all the unwitting blind instruments, which is precisely what we are in the hands of the creator of the world, come together to form a single, whole dramatic image, an event of singular grandeur that only the poet can survey. End quote. This allusion to Leibniz's monadic perspectivism situates genius in an analogous position to God. Herder closes his paean to Shakespeare by addressing especially young readers and announcing the coming of a new genius who will reawaken and reunite Germany's cultural heritage. This prophecy is fulfilled by a young man, whom Herder just befriended a year earlier in 1770, and who himself pays an enthusiastic tribute to Shakespeare in the same year. Goethe's speech even tops Herder's in terms of expressiveness, individuality, and self-awareness. It is considered the founding document of the German storm and stress period and the aesthetics of genius. I quote, I, who mean everything to myself, everything I know, I only know through myself. Thus exclaim those who feel themselves. Today, we honor the memory of the greatest wanderer, and in doing so, we honor ourselves, for we carry within us the seeds of the achievement of the achievements we value in others. End quote. By reading Shakespeare's works, Goethe claims, quote, I learned to see, and thanks to my enlightened genius, I still feel intensely what I have gained. The structure of Shakespeare's plays is no structure at all, yet each revolves around an invisible point, which no philosopher has discovered or defined, and where the characteristic quality of our individuality, our presumed free will, collides with the inevitable course of the whole. Our corrupted taste, however, so beclouds our vision that we almost require a new creation to pull us out from the darkness. End quote. Shakespeare's naturalist representation of man, his ability to crack open the inner life and thoughts of his characters and to expose the truth of life, sparks the imagination and creativity of his ingenious readers. So much so that Goethe enthusiastically exclaims at the climax point of his speech, quote, nature, nature, nothing is more nature than Shakespeare's figures. Shakespeare competes with Prometheus, imitating him by forming human beings feature by feature, but on a colossal scale. Then he brings them to life by breathing his spirit into them. He speaks through them all, and we recognize their kinship. End quote. The reference to Prometheus highlights another exemplary figure of genius as well as another aspect to reflect about and to conceive of this concept. Prometheus represents genius by shaping, like the God creator in Genesis, a new human race. And like him, Goethe wants to become a second maker of and for humanity by creating a poetic world. In the following, I cite a longer passage from Goethe's autobiography. As I was looking for an activity that would guarantee my autonomy, I found it most certainly in my productive talent. My fantasy has not stopped for 1 second to be creative during the last couple of years. Whatever vision I had at daytime turned more than once into regular dreams at nighttime. As soon as I then opened my eyes, something appeared that was forming a completely new whole image, miraculously from scratch and from parts already in place. As I reflected about this gift of nature, I realized that it was entirely my own and that it could be neither enhanced nor corrupted by anything external. Thus, I decided to establish my whole existence on reflecting on this gift, about this gift. This idea transformed in an image and brought to mind the mythological figure of Prometheus, who created, separately from the gods and by its own labor, a whole new world population. End quote. In this passage, Goethe identifies human autonomy with the faculty to be creative. Yet he says even more, namely that to be poetic also requires to reflect about this exclusive gift to him. This is, however, almost an impossible task to accomplish if you consider Kant's famous statement on the imagination in the Critique of Pure Reason, where he defines the schematic process, quote, as an art hidden in the depths of the human soul, whose true operations we will hardly ever discover in nature since they are not revealed to our eyes, end quote. Thus, the question is how we can observe and reflect on the imagination when it operates in the complete darkness of our subconscious. Goethe hopes to find access to the sources of the imagination by its genuine medium, which is not discursive thought, but intuitive poetry. The best example to demonstrate how young Goethe tackles the task of reflecting about his poetic imagination is found in one of his most important and famous poems, the Prometheus Ode. The theme of this ode is how Prometheus abjures Zeus to become the god of the world he molds out of clay. Zeus is conceived here very much also as an obfuscating placeholder of the Christian god and of the clerical aristocratic autocracy. Prometheus attacks Zeus and his apparatus by accusing them of their fundamental uselessness. Quote, I know of nothing more wretched under the sun than you gods. And later on he addresses himself. Did not you, my holy and glowing heart, accomplish it all alone? The holy and glowing heart is basically the symbol for genius. But not only is Prometheus a representation of the revolutionary spirit of the emancipating imagination, it is, moreover, also a poem about poetic production. The figure of Prometheus articulates and performs the crucial conflict of Goethe's entire poetic existence. Quote, here I sit, forming man in my image, a race to resemble me, to suffer, to weep, to enjoy, to be glad, and never to heed you like me. I cannot deliver a full interpretation of the poem here, but I would like to point out that the astonishing fact that this strophe, although it refers to the creative act which defines the present situation and the mise-en-scène of Prometheus' monologue, is actually not the poem's first but last strophe out of seven. This is important to note because this strophe marks everything that happens in the previous monologue as a product of Prometheus' retrospective imagination. Earlier, Prometheus accused Zeus to be an imposter of humanity, and he ultimately recognized him as a non-real, merely imaginary figure imposed by a belief system. Prometheus critically points out ideological trends of Zeus that simultaneously apply to Greek mythology, Platonic philosophy, Judeo-Christian theology, and the then popular idea of nationalistic poetics. He arrives to this insight by reflecting the evolution of his own self-consciousness and autonomous existence. Yet, by vividly remembering his past, his old anger against Zeus returns, which he is finally projecting in the image that he impresses on the humanity that he creates. Thus, the poem performs how Prometheus' imagination divides itself into two trajectories, one retrospective and the other projective, in the demigod's attempt to revoke events of the past in order to come to terms with the characteristics and qualities with which he wants to endow his humans. In other words, in the momentary act of creation at the end of the poem, the retrospective and the projective imagination collide. The re-envisioned conflict with the past Zeus is literally impressed into Prometheus' mind again and thereby passed down to his creatures, so that the future of a supposedly new and better humanity is spoiled by the old ideology right from the moment of its conception. So there's a kind of repetitiveness. Once you overcome Zeus, Zeus returns basically as a kind of imaginary figure that occupies basically the fantasy of Prometheus, who then passes this kind of hatred that he has against this image to the next generation. So we cannot escape basically this kind of ideology. Once we recognize the importance of the speech situation that motivates a poem, we realize that the division within Prometheus' imagination represents young Goethe's own strategy of mirroring his own. Like Prometheus, who eventually faces his own imagination in his recollection of the mythical Zeus figure, so does young Goethe confront his own fantasies by externalizing the inner conflicts of his creative state of mind in virtual role plays with imaginary others, in this case with the figure of Prometheus. That means that the Prometheus figure of the poem functions for Goethe in the same way as the Zeus figure functions for Prometheus in the poem, namely, as a figure that externalizes an inner conflict. In the rhetoric tradition, this figure of self-reflective speech is characterized as a soliloquy. In his essay, Soliloquy or Advice to an Author, Shakespeare propagates the ancient technique as a training method for young authors. In order to become his own subject, Shakespeare writes, a young poet must learn how to interrogate and to purify his imagination. Quote, by an inward rhetoric through which the mind apostrophizes its own fancies, raises them in their proper shapes and personages, and addresses them familiarly, end quote. Shakespeare further explains that the ancients' enigmatic concept of demon or genius meant, quote, that we had each of us a patient in ourself, that we were properly our own subject of practice, and that we then became true practitioners when, by virtue of an intimate recess, we could discover a certain duplicity of the soul and divide ourselves into two parties. And exactly this is what the poem does. This describes, in principle, what I identify as young Goethe's model of poetic self-observation, a model that Goethe employs with variations also in other poems and literary works. However, the very act of imagining or creating continues to remain a blind spot. Prometheus is incapable to recognize his fall and the shortcoming of his creation. He is not aware that, in the end, he occupies essentially the same oppressive position against his creation that Zeus had occupied in relation to him. As I mentioned earlier, mankind is not formed in the positive image of Prometheus' humanity, but rather in the negative one of Prometheus' hatred against Zeus. Eventually, Goethe's self-observation also needs to make visible the consequences of this unaccounted for moment. He needs to find another model of poetic self-reflection that also shows and assesses the exclusions, limitations, and consequences of the genuine blindness of the imagination in the very act and moment of creation. In order to do so, another perspective is required that remains within the realm of Goethe's poetical imagination, but transcends the limits and limitations of the single text. So this cannot be done by one single poem. There need to be more poems that then reflect each other. How Goethe accomplishes this is a longer story than I could possibly tell you here. I will simply say that young Goethe reflects the many implications and facets of genius in a whole series of intertwined poems. These so-called genius hymns, written in the 1770s, when Goethe was in his early 20s, perform a dialectics of poetic genius. Each poem responds to the shortcoming of the former and informs the following in Goethe's attempt to balance and self-control the great powers of the human imagination. After altogether 8 poems, a figure of the lyrical eye emerges that incorporates and represents the many facets of genius, that is, the possibilities, constraints, struggles, successes, and failures of poetic creativity. It is this figure of self-reflected poeticality that Goethe calls genius. And since this lyrical eye is a representative product of his poetic spirit in every single instance, Goethe's genius is able to see himself in the multifaceted mirror image of his poems and thus literally able to read the history of his self-awareness. So Goethe can basically document in these poems how he becomes self-aware of the problems of genius. That is basically what these poems are about. Each poem of the series serves as a memorial to a decisive moment in his poetic career, as a warning sign to the poetical imagination to not repeat the same mistake again. For example, in face of the monumental Prometheus Ode, Goethe's genius will be reminded of how the blindfolded poet is inherently threatened to establish yet another ideological regime of the imagination, in particular just after it has emancipated itself from an imaginary mythological, theological, and political belief system. The poem that immediately follows Prometheus in this series is entitled Ganymede. It commemorates just the opposite danger for the imagination, namely to remain caught in a contemplative aesthetic mode instead of transforming the pleasures of the beautiful and sublime into a poetical experience. Consequently, the figure of Ganymede completely loses its personal identity and corporeal integrity at the end of the poem, whereas Prometheus discovered his human and artistic identity even at the price of enclosing himself and his world in the confines of his superego. So these two figures are basically binary oppositions, and now showing basically two extremes of the imagination, an aesthetic, contemplative one, and a poetic, productive one. To resolve the tension between these two antagonistic extremes of genius, a synthesis of these two becomes necessary that accommodates both. This process requires a higher level of self-reflection, which task the lyrical eye performs and accomplishes in the subsequent poems. I will not go into detail here and only point out that in the final poem of the Hymns of Genius, entitled The Wanderer, the lyrical eye appears to be exhausted from the arduous task of permanent self-reflection. It is longing for rest, which the wanderer eventually finds in the face of a little boy whom he encounters in an idyllic landscape. He addresses the boy as another new genius who radiates an enjoyment of life that the wanderer also finds in the ever-blossoming nature surrounding them. This leads us finally to the last model of genius that marks Goethe's classical period after his journey to Italy in 1780. In Italy, Goethe had hoped to find the real primordial plant, but instead he discovered the idea of metamorphosis, according to which all plants can be generated by the various transformation of a single organ. For Goethe, all is leaf. Roots, trunks, petals, blossoms, and stamens are essentially only modifications of a single flexible, or as he calls it, transcendental form that materializes in specific shapes according to the inherent program. Goethe recognizes a structural analogy between the metamorphoses in nature, manifestations of poetic and artistic genius, and the cognitive development of the mind as outlined in Kant's transcendental philosophy. I can only claim it here. It would take much longer to prove it or to show it to you, but basically there are three inherent developments, in emergences, basically. So the poetic mind, the discursive mind, and nature, they all follow basically a similar kind of metamorphosis. Now, on the basis of the self-knowledge that it has already acquired, so that the genius or the self-reflection of genius already acquired, the poetic genius can rely on its close study of nature as an external regulatory measure for its own formation. Goethe articulates this insight beautifully in the elegy Metamorphosis of Plants that you have, which combines morphological science with a romantic love scene and even Kantian philosophy. Goethe finds support for this transfer of the measure of genius from introspective self-reflection to the observation of self-generating nature in probably the most influential modern definition of genius by Kant. In the Critique of Judgment, Kant considers genius as a manifestation of nature. Quote, "Genius is a talent or gift of nature which gives the rule to art. Since talent, as the innate productive faculty of the artist, belongs itself to nature, we may express the matter thus. Genius is the innate mental disposition, ingenium, through which nature gives the rule of art." End quote. For Kant, genius belongs to nature and is a rare gift to man, who prescribes rule to art and culture in return. Genius is the medium that bridges the creation of nature with the creativity of man. Kant attributes the following qualities to the work of genius: originality, as opposed to copying or pure imitation; exemplary beauty, which serves as an undeniable and universal model for all art and culture. Autonomy, the poetic or imaginative process, is irreversible and unique. One cannot learn to truly communicate how to write ingenious poetry. And finally, exclusivity. It is only in the happy cognitive mode of playful and creative genius that mankind is experiencing true freedom. Yet this cognitive mode of playful genius is solely a mode of creation. Kant clearly distinguishes the intuitively synthesizing poet and artist from the discursively analyzing philosopher and scientist. This has important implications for our topic. Kant would have denied Einstein, Darwin, and last but not least himself, membership in the exclusive club of geniuses. Unless we regard their scientific and philosophical systems not only as discoveries, but also as poetic speculations of the imaginative, creatively thinking mind. Let me conclude. We followed the metamorphosis of Goethe's genius in some of his poetic and poetological reflections. At the turn of modernity, genius is not only a special talent, but also requires self-regulative discipline to become productive and beneficial for all mankind. In that sense, it can be a precious gift. And yet, it remains a precarious one if the genuine blindness of its creativity is not accounted for. Then, the imaginative force of genius is at risk of turning into an overpowering and oppressive ideological power that has the potential to enslave others. Therefore, the reflection of the powerful forces of genius is an ethical obligation. This is essentially what the humanities strive for when we study and teach the writings and works of geniuses like Goethe. We experience the creative potential of our human race and remind ourselves what a precious gift the freedom of expressing our individuality can be. We are all potentially geniuses. However, we must learn first and foremost to respect the ideas of others and to balance our imagination through intellectual self-discipline. Thank you.